you so much, Steve. I am grateful to Steve for making this possible, and to Reem for doing the hard work on this one to make it possible, and Zeifman's for providing not only space but lunch. And I want to thank Nathan for dedicating the series in memory of his parents, Yataleya Bas Shemaya, Zichrona Levracha, and Moshe Yosef Ben David, Zichrona Levracha. A couple of notes. First of all, I mentioned the sign-in sheets. There are three of them scattered on different tables. In particular, if you're not getting the emails for the series, please make sure that you sign in so that I'll be able to notify you about future lunches. Okay, that's 1 point. Second, as noted on the flyer, the topics for the series were selected with an eye towards eligibility for continuing education credit. Unlike the classes that I do for the Law Society and for medical ethics, where they actually will tell you this is approved, the way it works is, you, I assume, know with financial services and the accounting societies that they don't tell you. They say, here are the guidelines for the type of thing you have to do, and go. So we pick the topics that that do seem to fit, but there's no formal process of getting the class approved for it. So that's all I can really say on the topic. Finally, if you have a cell phone, if you could please silence it, that would be great. Okay, so our topic is risk management and other people's money. The level of care necessary when you are investing for people or giving people financial advice, that's what we're dealing with. And there are going to be three cases that we're going to look at. But before we see what our cases are, I bring you a legal case. This involves lawyers, not financial services professionals, but I think it's still instructive nonetheless. The case involved a fellow named Mr. Chopra, who was an employee of Easy Plastic Containers. He was, it seems, and I can't really know from the decision, but he seems like he was a little bit of a rabble-rouser at the company. The company felt that he was giving them a hard time, creating a negative work atmosphere, and eventually they fired him. He felt that this was wrongful dismissal, and he sued. And his representatives did warn him that he could lose the case. And they said that they were not going to take a contingency fee. They wanted a flat fee for representing him, whether they succeed or not. And he continued pursuing the trial. He did not win in his suit of his former employer. And he got hit with a massive legal bill from the company DeVry Smith Frank that represented him. So he then was part of litigation involving DeVry Smith Frank regarding their claims for their costs in pursuing his defense, or his suit, I should say. So this is from the decision in that latter trial. Take a look at source number one. During the two-year run-up to the trial, Mr. Chopra was adamant that he wished to have his day in court. Mr. Chopra testified that he was told that his claim was strong and that Easy Plastic Containers would pay a portion of his costs. However, I find as a fact that although DSF did tell Mr. Chopra that the unsuccessful party typically pays costs to the winner, so they warned him this could happen, they told him there was a serious risk that he would be unsuccessful and that litigation is risky and outcomes cannot be predicted with any certainty. I find that DSF encouraged Mr. Chopra to settle his claim because of the risks of losing. I find that a mediator told Mr. Chopra much the same thing. He knew he could lose, and he knew that if he lost, he could end up paying not only his own legal fees, but also the legal fees of the other side. Certainly, by the time of the delivery of Easy Plastic Container's statement of defense, it should have been clear there was little for Mr. Chopra to gain and very much to lose in his having a day in court. Unless the cost of the litigation could be limited to approximately $25,000, nothing meaningful could be achieved. Had the cost exposure been contained, the family's upside was approximately $100,000. That was what he was suing for. And his downside, approximately $50,000. Even without the benefit of hindsight, and even in circumstances where the exposure to costs could be contained, the better advice from DSF would have been that Mr. Chopra should walk away and not expose his family in this way. If the law intended to enforce the deferred payment retainer, they ought to have warned Mr. Chopra in writing. It doesn't mean the law, it means DSF. They ought to have warned Mr. Chopra in writing. So in other words, even though they told him you could lose, and even though they warned him that the consequences of losing could involve paying the legal fees for not only his own, But even for the other side, nonetheless, they are still to a certain extent held responsible by the court for not doing enough in advising him. They should have gone further. Yeah.
The question is, did they say anything verbally? Unless you can prove it in writing.
Right. No, there were elements in writing. They didn't do everything in writing. This is true. But there were elements of their advice in writing. What seems to be here, based on that last paragraph, is that they should have actually told him, "Walk away. You're making a mistake here in pursuing this," and they never went that far with it. So that's really our question that I'm looking for here: is how far do you have to go in advising a client? When a client says to you, you're an accountant, you're taking care of the taxes, right? The client says to you, I want to assign this amount for my home office, right? I want to try the following strategy. And you think, you know what? I'm conservative. I'm cautious. I think this is a bad idea. And you say to them, people can get audited over this and you can get yourself into trouble with this. Is that sufficient? Do you actually have to go so far as to say, I won't do this for you? Like, what exactly is the expectation? So if you take a look at number two, this is from CPA Ontario's Code of Professional Conduct, and it's really the only part I could find that spoke directly to this issue. Section 202 requires integrity and due care as well as objectivity. So under integrity and due care, it says, a member or firm shall perform professional services with integrity and due care. Well, that's pretty vague, right? Does due care include that you have to warn the client in the strongest possible terms and say, no, don't do this? How far do you go? The guidance doesn't really help. The guidance writes, members and firms have duties to those to whom they provide professional services that arise from the nature of the relationships with the recipients of the services. Members and firms have a professional duty to act with integrity and due care, and a contractual duty to provide services as defined by the terms of their engagement or employment. Right? Two separate responsibilities. Professional duty, you're going to be an accountant, you're part of the accounting society, You need to have the integrity and due care element, and then contractually you have to do whatever you agreed to do. In certain cases, the relationship between a member or firm and those to whom they provide professional services could also be one the courts describe as a fiduciary relationship, that's a third level, that gives rise to fiduciary duties, where you are going to be responsible to look after their finances. So our question is going to be, how does all of this apply to advising of risk, both from a law society perspective and from a halachic perspective? What will the Torah have to say about this? So take a look at three, where you have the cases. We're going to go through the cases. I'll ask you for brief opinions on each of them before we get into the sources on it. First case, this is the one that I modified, meaning I first sent out my set of cases, but by the time I was done preparing everything, I realized I wanted to change the first case. So you have to catch this one. I took out the neurosurgeon, put in an accountant instead. David and Ari are leaving synagogue together one Sunday morning. David asks Ari, a professional tax accountant, for advice regarding a particular tax issue. Ari suggests a strategy. David follows it. David ends up in trouble with the CRA. It's like a picture book. Is Ari liable?
Is there any monetary consideration?
No monetary consideration. This was just, two guys talking on their way out of the synagogue.
No engagement letter.
No engagement letter.
Get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for. The advice is given for free, and the buyer beware, so to speak.
Well, there's no professional relationship here.
Right.
As far, somebody asking just what, can I pick your brains, to me is not a professional relationship.
Right. No, and I think that's clear. I 100% agree. This is not a professional relationship. Okay.
If it was in good faith, if it was not in good faith, then you could say that the principal, which we learned 2 weeks ago, if Major Bellows was sitting in this shop,
yeah,
he was just talking out of his hat. But if he meant it very sincerely and it was research, the question is, makes another question, was he acting against Halacha?
Right, so that's an interesting question which we may get to. The question of, what if Ari's advice is actually objectively really bad advice? It's not just like, he said investing in gold is a good idea, where somebody might think yes, somebody might think no. But he gave him a flat, bad piece of advice. How bad does it have to be in order for him to be liable when, again, there's no consideration, there's no letter of engagement, there's two guys standing in the parking lot schmoozing. So I want to actually move to the second case.
I was just going to comment. Whatever advice was given, have a caution. Go ahead, it sounds like lots of people are doing this, but wait until I have a chance to research this further. Could be otherwise.
Oh boy, well then you're really going to be in trouble. For giving, if you give advice and you say, I'm researching this further, once you present yourself as giving something that's professional and researched, even if there's no letter of engagement, even if there's no consideration, you might run into trouble. I'm neither an accountant nor a lawyer, let's be clear. This is a good time to say that, but I think that the closer you get to presenting your advice as professional advice as opposed to two friends just talking, the more trouble you can get yourself into. So I'm going to come back to this. We have two other cases to see and a whole lot to discuss. Second case. Susan is a professional certified investment advisor, and Sally retains her services. Susan advises Sally to purchase a particular stock, noting that all investments carry risk. Sally buys. The stock's value plummets and never recovers. Is Susan liable?
No.
If a regular advice, no.
Depends on the quality of the advice.
Not yet.
Was it bad advice? Was it good advice?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see. We have to come back to that one as well. Case number three. Robin is a professional certified investment advisor, and Sam retains Robin's services. Robin advises Sam to purchase gold, because Robin expects the commodity to recover strongly in 2 years. Sam was chasing immediate returns, though, as Sam needs that investment money to marry off a daughter in a year. Is Robin responsible for having given inappropriate advice?
It depends on what information you
gave. Need more information.
Right. Was the information communicated? Was the information asked for? Right? You have to start from there. Right? Did I lose track of who is who? If Robin didn't ask, you know, what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve? How soon do you need your returns? Then there's a very clear-cut problem. So we're going to come back to that. This is what's called the Know Your Client rule, and we're going to come back to this. Yes, Irvin.
No, you're right. You have a common denominator in both those cases, and that is the operative word of having retained.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
However, it depends on the exculpatory clauses in each case, protecting them on the advice that they're given. Because they can say that we are, you know, we basically exclude ourselves from any responsibility. We will offer you this advice based on the best information, best knowledge.
Right. So exculpatory clauses can work on certain things. They can't work on everything. There are certain bedrock principles of professional practice.
But wouldn't it depend in both these cases on what actually is the contract?
So I'm going to come back to that in approximately 1 minute. So it's a good point. Hang in there. So what I want to do is begin by looking in general at how we look at, and this is going to be a Jewish law perspective, how we look at the responsibility of financial services advisors for the assets that are in their care. And once we know that, that will take us to the ability to answer these three questions from a Jewish law perspective, interspersing the general rules of society along the way. So there are two approaches to this that we can dispose of at the outset. The first approach that we can dispose of at the outset, not because it's wrong, but because it renders the entire discussion moot, is the exculpatory clause. I said 1 minute. It might be a minute and a half. You'd have to look on the recorder. But I noted here source number four. This is from a very interesting article. The article has some problems, but overall it's a very interesting article called The Investment Advisor, Liabilities and Halachic Identity. By Rabbi Dr. A. Yehuda Warburg. He is not only an expert in the field, but he's also a dayan. He's a judge on a Beit Din, on a rabbinical court that hears these cases. And it's worth reading this article of his. So he says, assuming that both parties are willing to sign an arbitration agreement or execute a kinyan, symbolic act of undertaking an obligation, empowering dayanim, arbitrators, to resolve this matter, using whatever principle they're going to use, I'm not going into Pshara and the different varieties, then it's in the panel's discretion to award damages for acts of grama and so on. Basically what he's saying, I shouldn't even have bothered to go into it because he's using terms that we're not up to yet, but what Rabbi Dr. Warburg points out here is you can sign an agreement to say, we're going to go by this system of law, we're going to go by that system of law, these are the terms under which we're going to function, in which case, not our first case, our first vignette, obviously, because there is no letter of anything there, but in our second or third cases, you can stipulate whatever you like, and those will be the terms that govern your relationship. So you can do that, but that takes all the fun out of the discussion. So I'm assuming that didn't happen in our cases. The second approach, which I'm going to eliminate, but I mention it because I think it's interesting, is the Talmud has discussions, which I brought you a source for here in source number 5 from a Mishnah, but it's all over the Talmud, about partnership relationships in which you have an investing partner and a managing partner. One person puts up the money and the other one does the work. And the source I brought you from number 5 is one example of it. It speaks of a situation in which you have two parties. One person provides the merchandise and the other person acts as the vendor. Another case in which one person provides the cash and the other one is going to be the manager. And here they're dealing with a completely separate consideration. Their concern here in number 5 is an issue of rebate, of interest on loans. If I view it as the person who puts up the money lent the money to the other person, who's then going to be giving back a return on the investment in addition to the original investment, are there issues of interest? But the point for our purpose is, could you make the argument that in the event that I, let's say, am the investor, okay, and Shragi is going to be my advisor, so when I give him the money to invest on my behalf, can you make the argument that this is a partnership in which I am the investing partner and he is the managing partner? Can you make that argument? Because if you do, you know all the rules, because the Talmud is very clear on what the obligations are in such partnerships. Shragi, assuming we were to follow this line of thinking, we would say that he would be responsible to treat my property the way that he takes care of his own. And there are all sorts of rules that govern what he can do. Source number 6 I brought you from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. But I have a format that works, if I can call this a partnership. Does that work? Does it work to structure this as a partnership in which I'm the investor and he's the manager?
No, that is, I think, because they're not sharing profits.
Right. The answer is no.
The investor can only make money. I'm sorry, the investor can lose money or make money, but the investment advisor can only make money.
Correct.
So it's not a partnership.
Right, so that doesn't work. Sorry. This is also true. This is also true. But that's a fundamental difference, and that's why this formulation doesn't work. You can't call it a partnership. That you have to discard. But what this will leave us with, by getting rid of where you just wrote everything up in a document and that governs what you're doing, and getting rid of the partnership example as well, that leaves us with 3 other formulations, which we're going to work our way through. They're not mutually exclusive. They overlap each other, and each one comes with its own understanding of the level of liability. So, Shragi, you're not my partner anymore. I apologize. Next time. The first way to look at it involves the highest tolerance for risk. And that is to say, the advisor does not have any duty to me any more than anybody else does. There is no duty of care. All there is do no harm. Don't be a mazik. Don't damage my property. We have in general, within Judaism, a principle which in number 8, I brought you the biblical verse 4, you shall not put a stumbling block before the blind, which includes, as I brought you in source number 9 from the Midrash, you shall not give people bad advice. This is a basic obligation that we must be sure not to cause other people to stumble. This even includes not allowing them to stumble on their own. If I see that they are going to stumble, I am responsible to stop them. This is a general duty of care that exists within society, not unique to people who have a particular relationship. So based on that, I'm not allowed to cause somebody else harm. I couldn't give somebody bad advice.
That's the risk plan for that.
So risk will play into that because let's take a scenario in which I come to you and I say, I have money that I'd like to invest. And you say, well, you know, what kind of returns do you want? And I say to you, I'd like 10% annual returns. And you say, well, if you want 10% annual returns, you know, here's a portfolio that you're going to need and maybe you'll be able to succeed. Right? Without warning me that it's a very volatile portfolio. I'm not going to start mentioning particular investments because I know even less about investments than most people. The question now is, I came to you not knowing anything, and you put forth this very risky portfolio on the basis of me saying I like 10% without giving me the downside or without sufficiently warning me that I could lose everything in this regard. So the question would be, would you view this as damage? Would you view this as putting a stumbling block in front of the blind? That will be the question here. Or do we say, look, it's risky. Investments are risky in general. We have a disclaimer that says past performance may not and so on. And that's sufficient. That will be the question within this first model. Your only responsibility is do no harm. Are you considered to be doing harm when you expose your client to risk?
I think it's very simple. If you give full disclosure, you're not responsible. It doesn't matter what case you're...
What does full disclosure mean?
Full disclosure means you tell the risk, you tell the time period, you give any information that pertains to what the individual is asking.
DSF warned Mr. Chopra about the risk. That wasn't sufficient. That was a practice of law. It's different.
Law requires it in writing. In this type of circumstances, the risk is the verbal, and you have a witness that confirms the verbal information. I would still put it in writing.
I think you always want to put it in writing. So this isn't clear-cut. And it isn't clear-cut for two reasons. One reason it's not clear-cut is because, well, basically, even if you gave bad advice, let's say we determine the advice you gave me for the investment was bad advice. At the end of the day, are you liable for just giving bad advice? Meaning, I understand there's a biblical prohibition against giving bad advice, but is it actionable? Is there anything I can do to somebody who told me to do something and then it turned out, you know, it didn't work out well? Or do I say, no, it's not his fault. Yeah, he gave me advice. Those are just words. They don't actually have any substance in terms of the law. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Rashba, in source number 10, argued that no, there's no such thing as liability in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court, for giving somebody bad advice. He talks about a case in which somebody had an eved, somebody had a servant, a non-Jewish slave. There was slavery, under what terms, is a great discussion, but entirely not for right now. He had somebody who wasn't Jewish, who was in his employ, and somebody else came along and said to him, you know, you can get out of this if you convert to Judaism. Conversion is going to end your servitude, and the fellow converts. Now, the person who had the Eved before is very angry. He says, what did you do to me? You cost me something. Rashba says, that's fine, but, you know, giving advice will never lead to financial liability. The end of the source in number 10, we never find that one who gives advice is liable in human courts, even for causing harm. And this is a term which we saw referenced in source number 4. The term is grumma. Grumma means to cause something, but specifically to cause something indirectly. You didn't do something direct to the other party. Ligrum. And here I bring you source number 11.
Sorry, in all these cases, the person who's providing the advice is not conflicted.
Correct.
So when the broker says this is a portfolio I recommend, he may believe it is a portfolio I recommend, even if he could be wrong. Then on the other hand, he could be right. Mm-hmm. And risk is a very hard thing to get a handle on.
Yes.
It looks like a risky portfolio could really be much less risk. That people have different views on things. And conversion, advice to the evidence to convert, also, the person who provides advice in these cases has no benefit from what they're doing. I'm sure the broker would prefer to give good advice if they could. But it would be different, I suppose, if the advice you give someone is bad, or somehow, you know, you're advising to sell something, but you're really indirectly the buyer.
Well, in this...
If you're conflicted, maybe that would be different.
I mean, in this case, you could even structure it where he had something to gain. The Evan came to him and said, I need to get out of this. You know, I entered this thinking it will be great, he's going to support me, whatever, and now I'm miserable. What can I do? And and you say to him, well, if you give me fill-in-the-blank fee, I'm going to tell you what to do.
You think that would not, that wouldn't change anything?
No, it wouldn't change a thing. No. Fundamentally, you're not responsible. You gave him advice and he did it. What's the, you know, it's all verbal. Indirect harm is fundamentally not liable in court. Take a look at source number 11. The source number 11, a passage out of the Talmud. Yeah.
Number 10 for a second. There's one thing here, and that is the person who took the advice, not the person who suffered the loss.
Correct.
I mean, the other one's person who took the advice.
Yes, that is true. Even though there is a distinction to be made in the sense that in the case with the Eved, the person you advised was not the person who suffered the loss.
Very happy.
Correct. No, that's true. And the point is still that it's speech that leads to harm. Whether it's to the harm party or to somebody else doesn't seem to make a distinction. Yeah.
I would ask, is there a difference if a broker, if you're investing for a broker and they're actually doing the tracery?
Good.
They're doing more than doing
good
for you.
Right, so you're ahead of me, but you are 100% right. We're going to have to go to that point. It's not only verbal. They're actually executing the trade. Yes.
What does the Rashba do with source number 9?
What does the Rashba do with source? He says that there's no liability for it. There's a difference between saying you're not supposed to do something and saying that a rabbinical court is going to charge you for having done it. That would be the distinction. So in source number 11, we find a case of grumma, indirectly caused damage. It talks about somebody who throws something from the roof, but he's throwing it down onto cushions. There are pillows below. He wants to get something down from the roof. He drops it off the roof over the cushions, and then somebody else comes along and pulls away the cushions before it lands. And now it smashes on the ground. You indirectly cause the destruction of his property. However, the rule is you are exempt from liability. That is called grumma. And that I brought you in source number 12. It is ruled that way in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles rules that you are indeed not liable. So if I stop here, it sounds like no liability. So I gave you bad advice. Happens. Maybe I violated the law because I put a stumbling block in front of the blind. You still can't claim anything from me. Not so fast. Because while there is a category called grumma, there is also a category called garmi. We talked about garmi about 4 years ago when we had a class here. I understand if you don't remember anymore, the lunch is long gone. But we talked about garmi at the time when we talked about professional malpractice, which obviously overlaps with what we're talking about now. So source number 13 is a key passage in the Talmud for this topic, and it talks about a money changer. Take a look. I'm reading out the English rather than the Hebrew in the interest of time, but I want the Hebrew readers to actually have the original, so I brought the Hebrew as well. If one shows a coin to a money changer, you went to the money changer, who's supposed to be an expert in identifying which coins are going as currency and which coins are not. You showed it to the money changer. Money changer says, this looks good. You accepted the coin in your transaction because the money changer said it looks good. Then you tried to use it somewhere and it got rejected. You got bad advice from the money changer. So I have two different sources. One source says that if you're an expert money changer, you're exempt. Not you, the person with the coin, the person who you showed it to. If he's an expert money changer, she's an expert money changer, they're exempt from liability. The reason being, because they did everything in their power to get training. They didn't get everything right, because no one's perfect. But they did everything they could to insulate the customer from error. However, I have a second source that disagrees. Second source says, no, you're liable no matter what, whether you're an expert or not. And the Talmud wants to understand, which is it? Is the expert exempt from liability, or is the expert liable? So Rav Papa comes along and explains it. He says, the view that exempts an expert is talking about an expert like Danko and Isser, two people from Talmudic times who got their names into the Talmud by being expert money changers. That's their claim to fame. They made it into the Talmud for all time. They lacked no knowledge. They were expert in every aspect of the field. And they'd make a mistake only if there was a newly minted coin and there wasn't enough information about it yet, so then they might make a mistake. But otherwise, they would never make a mistake. If you're truly an expert, that's the case in which you're exempt. That's source number one. Source number two that said you're liable is where you're not fully trained. That's from Papa's statement. Then the Talmud challenges and says, I have a story of Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya was an expert. He was shown a coin. He wasn't paid for it. Some woman came to him and said, I want you to tell me, is this coin okay? He says, yeah, he approves it, looks good. Next day she comes back to him and she complains. She said, I tried to use it. They wouldn't accept it. What did you do to me? So Rabbi Chia told Rav, his nephew, exchange it for her. It's a bad deal. Write it off as a bad deal. So the Talmud says, why? He should be exempt. He was as expert as Danko and Yisra. Rabbi Chia was apparently a well-trained money changer. Yeah, you're right. He did lefnim mishur es hadin. He went beyond the letter of the law. He wasn't obligated to. He felt bad. He said, you know what? I told her to accept it. It's my fault. I'll reimburse her for it. That's Rabbi Chia's case. Then we get the case of Rabbi Elazar. Reish Lakish shows a coin to Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar, as I added in the brackets, was not an expert. He approved the coin. Reish Lakish said to him, I'm relying on you. Rabbi Elazar says, what does that mean? If you're trying to tell me that if it turns out to be bad, I should reimburse you, I'm not liable anyway. Because you yourself have taught that only Rabbi Meir says that I would be liable. It's only Rabbi Meir's view. No one else agrees. What is Rabbi Meir's view? What he's talking about is the principle of garmi. Garmi means that you've actually caused somebody harm directly. Not indirectly, but directly. And if you cause somebody harm, well, I shouldn't say directly, because it's not direct. You didn't smash someone's property. If you cause somebody harm indirectly, but it's strong enough, the possibility that was going to lead to a problem was strong enough that you should have known that this could happen, then you're liable for it. That's what garmi refers to here. It's indirect, but it's not. If you take a look at source number 14, the Code of Jewish Law says, we indeed follow the view of Rabbi Meir, quoted at the end of 13. He punishes for garmi. He punishes for this type of damage. So that the rule is that if you're a money changer and you didn't gain proper expertise, then you are going to be responsible for the results of your bad advice. Ah, but it was bad advice. Didn't the Rashba tell me you're not liable for bad advice? If there's a direct line between your bad advice and the harm, then you are going to be responsible. Even though all you did was give advice. And here, hold on, I want to show you source number 15, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who was both an employee of a bank and a judge on rabbinical courts for many years, and wrote what is considered one of the major works on financial law today, called Pitchei Choshen, says what you see in number 15. An investment advisor who advises to make a bad investment would appear to be liable under the law of the money changer. A tax advisor who causes a client a loss via his advice would appear to be judged under the law of one who, again, goes to the money changer. It's considered to be a direct enough line. Alan and then Irving. Yeah?
Is that the same as Zeman's concept of foreseeability?
Yes. That's exactly what it is.
Or the basically foreseeability.
Right. You should have known that this was going to cause harm, and even though all you did was speak, you didn't execute the trade or anything, nonetheless, there will be liability for you. Irving.
In Rav Papa's example, there's an inconsistency in his thinking. He's saying that there was a lack of no knowledge. There was a lack of knowledge.
In which case?
In the first case.
Which case do you mean by the first case?
In the very top.
If one shows the coin to a money changer and then it's rejected?
He says his reasoning is based on the money changer lacked no knowledge.
Right.
He did lack knowledge. He didn't know about the newly minted coins.
Right. So anytime there's an error, unless someone is pernicious, right, we say that there must have been some level of ignorance. But what he means is accessible knowledge. He had achieved the maximum training that one could reasonably be expected to achieve. That's what he's saying. You're right. Technically speaking, he made a mistake. Clearly there was something wrong. Agreed. Okay, so garmi will carry liability. One view is that garmi carries liability because we consider it a type of vandalism. You did cause harm to the other party. I brought you source 16 on it, but I'm skipping it in the interests of time. A second approach to why you're liable for garmi is a very important one. So the second approach is, and I brought it for you here from Rav Shabtai HaKohen, the Shach, that Garmi really is still indirect. However, the sages find when they judge a circumstance to be common, like this, and one cannot compare decrees, he says, Garmi is really still indirect. However, it's a common form of harm. And therefore, they said, we need to punish people who cause this kind of harm to others, because even though their role was indirect, at the end of the day, if we don't rein this in, it's going to create chaos. And based on that argument, Rabbi Warburg, in source number 18, says, you know what? He says, we have all sorts of problems going on today in terms of investment advice and in terms of fraud within companies. Maybe we should create new garmi punishments, cases of liability based on what's going on today. However, in source number 19, the Shach disagrees, and the Shach says you can't add cases today. We don't do that. The bottom line is, what emerges from here is that you can be liable for financial advice where, to use the term that the Gemara uses, bari hezeka, the danger of it is clear. And that's what we would call foreseeability. So that's one way to look at it. That was going to take the major part of our time. So don't worry about the fact that we're now 35 minutes in. We tolerate risk, but if there's foreseeable harm, then you are going to carry liability. And that's one way to look at it. The responsibility of the agent, of the advisor, is not to cause foreseeable harm. However, there's another way to look at it. You are a shaliach. You're an agent. You are hired with particular instructions. Do these tasks and don't veer from the instructions. Agency means, if you take a look at number 21, the first duty of an agent is to comply explicitly with the orders of his principal. You're supposed to follow the instructions that you've been given. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein used that formulation in discussing a case in which a broker was given instructions to sell, and the broker didn't do so. And he said, the broker's liable. You were given instructions, you didn't carry out the instructions. And this adds a layer of liability over and above the mazik, the person who actively causes harm. Because now you're liable not only for active harm, but for failure to fulfill the instructions. And if you, as the advisor, are given instructions to invest in a certain way, right, with a certain tolerance level for risk, but not beyond that, then you're going to be responsible for not having honored that. There's a side discussion about what if you veer from the instructions you've been given, but your veering from the instructions didn't lead to the loss. But in the interest of time, I'm going to skip that, only noting that for those who are interested, it's source number 24. So that's a second way to look at it, is you are an agent. And then there's a third model. And the third model, to me, is the most pertinent of the three. The first one is mazik, don't cause active harm. The second one is don't veer from the instructions you've been given. The third one is what we call shomer sachar. You are a paid guardian. You're guarding somebody else's assets. So the money has value. The shares in the account have value. And you are supposed to oversee them. And the big difference between this and the previous two cases is that a shomer sachar, a guardian, is liable for pshia, is liable for carelessness, and is also liable for grama, for indirectly caused harm. If you take a look at source number 25, Maimonides says it. He says, if one gives his vineyard to a guardian, whether for sharecropping or unpaid guardian, doesn't matter, with a condition that he do certain jobs, and the guardian was careless and didn't do so, the guardian is liable as though he had actively damaged it. That's the rule. So it comes up in very interesting cases. For example, somebody gives me chametz before Passover, before Pesach, and I'm supposed to watch it for him. It's Erev Pesach. What do I do now with the chametz that he gave me to watch? I'm responsible to sell it off. And that way he'll still have his money. That's what I'm supposed to do. What if I did not sell it to him? Rabbi Avram Gambiner says, I am liable. That was careless supervision of the property that had been given to me to guard. I had to actively go out there and sell it when I saw it deteriorating. Not everybody agrees. Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, in source number 28, disagreed. He says, no, that's not my responsibility. I don't have to do that. The only reason I was supposed to sell it off is because Hashem has a veda. Don't let him lose money. But it's not like I have to pay for failure to do so. But the Chasam Sofer of Moshe Sofer disagreed in source number 29. He defended the Magen Avraham and said, I would indeed be liable for failure to act to save his property from harm. The analogy is to a person who's been given animals to guard. And then wild animals attack, but I could fight them off. So if I don't fight them off, if I'm able to fight them off and I don't do so, then it's my liability. And not only that, I'd be liable for grumma, for indirect causation as well. Source number 30, Rabbi Meir Auerbach, in the Imre Bina, dealt with a case in which there were part there was somebody who had an IOU. He owed money to another person. He paid off part of the debt. Let's say he owed $1,000, he paid off $500. Now there's a partial IOU of $500. The fellow he owed the money to turned around with the document and gave it to somebody else to be able to use without editing it to say it's only $500. So the other person can now claim $1,000 from this guy. So he says that's called grumma. You're liable. Sorry, it's called grumma. It's indirect causation, but you're going to be liable for it. The distinctions of grumma and garmi don't apply in cases of shomer sachar of a guardian. So we have three different formulations. I'm rushing a little bit because of time, but I hope it's going to be clear. We have three formulations we work with. We discarded two formulations in the beginning. We're not dealing with where you wrote everything out in a contract, because then there's nothing to discuss. You put it in black and white, and you're good. We're not talking about it as a partnership, because the investment advisor is not making any money on the investment, he's just getting his fee. But we have the formulation of you as the advisor are an outsider, so just don't cause harm. Don't cause direct harm via garmi, or you will be liable. We have the second possibility that you are the agent, which is even stronger when you're actually the one executing the trade. In which case we say, so don't veer the instructions that you receive. Don't veer from the instructions you receive. And then we have the third possibility, which is you are the guardian of the property, in which case you have very broad responsibility and liability for failure to anticipate loss. So now your risk tolerance is very low, right? Your risk tolerance is really high if you're not responsible for anything other than garmi. I gave him a risky thing, but it wasn't like it was terrible. On the other end, at this point, I could be responsible for almost everything under these parameters. I'm responsible for indirect harm. So let's talk about our cases. The first case that we had, the two guys in the parking lot outside of the synagogue. You are not a shaliach, you're not his agent, you've accepted no agency. There's no agreement to work for him. You are not a shomer sachar, you're not a guardian of his property either. The only question is whether your speech would be considered garmi. Is your speech considered to be direct harm? From the accounting society's perspective, you're fine. I brought it for you in source number 31. Members are reminded they may also be performing professional services when serving in the capacity of a volunteer, and accordingly are subject to the requirement for objectivity when acting in that capacity. Objectivity you are required to have, but what did they omit in this line? No, due care. They omitted due care. This is this piece, 31, is the comment that goes all the way back to number 2. They're commenting on Rule 202, which talked about integrity, due care, and objectivity. You only have to have objectivity. You can't give him bad advice, tell him invest in the company, which, by the way, happens to be your company. But you don't have a due care responsibility if you're just a volunteer. That's from the accounting society's perspective. From a Jewish law perspective, you are also exempt from liability because you're not being paid. And therefore, there is no assumption that you are going to be, that he is relying on you. The source 32 is the Code of Jewish Law. Statement number 33 is Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan explaining why you are exempt. He says, the guy isn't relying on you. He knows. He's not paying you. He can't rely on the advice that you are giving. That's the key idea here. There is no duty of care established, and therefore, both from a halachic perspective and from an accounting society perspective, you're exempt from liability. I'm just going to rush to the end, and then I'll take questions. But I want to make sure that I get to this.
I just wanted to say that from a legal perspective, there is no liability.
Okay, we can come back to that at the end and discuss. But that's case number 1. Case number 2, the professional advisor whose advice turns out to be bad. So if the advice was sound and things just went wrong, so you're fine. Because you're like the money changer who did everything to get proper training. So you got proper training, you're an expert, but that's the way it works. You know, you don't win every time. If the advice is negligent, then we have a garmi situation. You gave advice which led to a problem and you should have known. And even if it's grama, even if you'll say it's indirect, we could still argue for liability, either because you didn't follow the prescribed risk tolerance level, or because, as a shomer, as a guardian, you're liable for grama, you're liable for indirect causation. So therefore, if the advice is negligent, halacha will indeed hold you liable. And I think the accounting society as well. What about your disclaimer? All investments are subject to risk. So if it's sound advice, that works. But if it's not sound advice, that doesn't help you. Source 35, Rabbi Dr. Warburg says, I'm skipping his wrestler analogy. He says, should the professional broker offer negligent advice, the customer may sue for damages. Clearly, his assumption of risk was limited to receiving sound investment counsel. Right? When someone says to me, this could be risky, I'm assuming this is a normal level of risk, not he's throwing darts at a dartboard. So if the advice is negligent, your disclaimer ain't going to help you. And then case number 3, the non-tailored advice. So the secular standard as established in the case of Varco Sterling in source number 36 requires know your client. You have to know what it is that the client wants, and as the source begins in 36, brokers are required to comply with the regulations governing the conduct of their client's affairs. The cardinal rule of the brokerage business is the know your client rule. A broker who opens an account for a client is required to obtain from the client an account application form, detailed information about age, employment, income, net worth, and so on. And so that becomes the requirement I gave you also from the investment industry in source number 37, the same requirement. So from a secular standpoint, you're absolutely required to know what it is that the client wants, and if you don't, then you will be liable. What about from a Jewish law perspective? Do you have any such requirement of know your client? So number one, there's the concept of Dina de Malchuta, law of the land, being important, although it's not clear how far it goes in extending to industry regulations. So I'll put that on the side. There is certainly the issue of lifnei iver, of not giving bad advice. And your advice has to be tailored for the person. And I talked to Baruch Weintraub, who used to be with our Beit Midrash, and he pointed me to source number 38, which is an interesting example of this. It's talking about a Yibum situation. In a Yibum situation, a man's brother died without leaving behind any children to his wife. And there's an option now for the widow to marry her brother-in-law or to not marry the brother-in-law. So they could do Yibum, or they could do Chalitza. That's the decision. And the Talmud here mentions that they're supposed to, the court, the rabbinical court, is supposed to give advice to the brother-in-law based on his circumstance. Advice that suits him. You have to give advice that fits the particular circumstance. And so I think that this is true, that we will expect this also from a Jewish law perspective. It's not enough that you say this in general is good. You have to think about the person you're talking to and whether this is good to be good for them. I realize that I rushed through the last 10 minutes of this, so I'm going to remain and take questions and so on. If anyone has to leave, they can do so, although they should say Birkat HaMazon first. But once again, I want to thank Nathan for dedicating a memory of his parents, and I want to thank Zeifman's for hosting. And now I'll take questions and comments, and we can continue the conversation for those who can remain. Jeffrey, and then Sheldon. Yeah.
Yeah. So from a legal perspective, radio liability. One. As far as the rules of the professional accountants, that goes to their governing body.
Right.
Same thing in the law society, those rules are not binding on the court. It's a fact where the court may take into consideration in assessing liability. All that does over here, too, I assume, is you won't be sanctioned by the accountant society,
right.
Won't be sanctioned by the law society. But that doesn't get you out of necessarily out of liability legally. And it depends on the case. But just it's not a good idea to give anyone professional advice.
Right. I mean, what you're talking about is related also. I didn't go into it, but the discussion of what happens if somebody says to you, I am relying on you. Right? So you haven't entered into a letter of engagement. There is no agreement from your side to say that we're working together and I'm going to give you proper advice. You're just a guy standing in a parking lot. He says to you, well, I'm relying on you. Does that trigger a responsibility for you to say, don't rely on me, this is bad advice? At that point, do you have to protect yourself in that manner? And that's certainly where the lawyer will say, this is not legal advice, don't act on it. And I think that's sound. But from a halachic perspective, saying, I am relying on you may be insufficient to create a level of responsibility such that the Beit Din would hold you liable. If you go back to the Aruch HaShulchan in source number 33, he addresses that. He says, if the money changer is not expert, he is liable if the client told the money changer, I depend on you, or if his words demonstrate that he depends entirely on his examination. Otherwise, we should not hold the money changer liable. He could say, I didn't know you would depend on me alone, dot, dot, dot. And some say the money changer is liable even if the person did not say, I depend on you, since he takes payment. But what he doesn't address is the case where there is no payment, and just, I am relying on you. And I think there is a lot of room for doubt as far as what the rule would be. Sheldon?
So I'm looking back at this example here about the KYC form.
Yeah.
Here contains detailed information about the client's age, employment, income, net worth, trading experience, and so on and so forth. The most critical factor designed here is risk tolerance.
It was there, wasn't it?
No. Risk tolerance. You wouldn't give the same advice to somebody who's 2 years away from retirement.
Right.
As someone who's 25 years old and has a lifetime of
capacity ahead of them. Right. I think I assumed it was included in trading objectives, but you're right. Risk tolerance is not specified in the wording of the ruling here. It's an interesting point. I wonder if more recent rulings did add it, but it's not in the 1992 ruling. It's
so
an interesting point.
Maybe the liability would depend on who that client is. Somebody who can afford risk or somebody who can't afford
risk. Right. Correct. Correct. Nathan.
So just to be clear, in terms of what the FORA obligation is in comparison to, common law.
Yeah.
Like common law, I presume, it's not like if you give bad advice, that doesn't make you liable as long as you're not negligent. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So from a Torah perspective, is that like you have to go beyond that kind of principle as well, or beyond that, or that principle would effectively be the
right. So it seems like
way to govern yourself.
It seems like you have to go beyond that because we articulate a threshold of getting expert training. Right? If I give advice without that expert training, you're treating me as someone who was careless. So I think that's a higher threshold than what would generally be considered in society carelessness. Meaning, let's take the case in which you have somebody who is taking classes and is not yet certified. Right? From a Jewish law perspective, I think he's going to be liable for the advice that he gave. Is he going to be liable in the secular? Would that be called careless? Would that be called negligent, I should say?
I'm not sure.
That's an interesting question, then, for the next time I do this topic. I wonder about how this works, whether this is considered negligence if you haven't yet completed your certification. Yeah, I don't know. Moshe, you had your hand, and then Alan.
Well, basically, according to the court system and the way the judges rule, as long as you offer a disclaimer, I don't care what field, it could be accountant, it could be legal, anything, you put the disclaimer beforehand, saying directly, do not give legal advice or anything else, you're immediately have no responsibility whatsoever for the advice you get. That's kind of what it is. Bad, good, medium.
Okay.
As long as, once you put that disclaimer in,
I'm not sure that's true.
So it's up to the other individual to accept or not your advice. Why don't you disclaim?
I'm pretty sure that's not always true. That if they give you every indication that they're relying on you, you can still get into trouble. Again, I'm not sure, but I'm not going to.
I think I have case law that actually shows.
Okay. Alan, and then I think Shoshana had a. No? Okay. Alan, and then Irving.
A little bit of farther to the field. So, based on historical types of transactions where somebody goes to his rebbe or his sees his rebbe for advice and says, should I invest in this transaction? Should I buy this commodity and I can sell it in this other city and make a lot of money? And the rebbe says, go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be a very bad advice.
Right.
The rebbe liable.
Is the Rebbe liable? So he got all the training needed to be able to give the advice. He got the expert training. It's an interesting question. You could make the argument that this is garmi, right? You could make the, and therefore, even if you are an expert, you could end up carrying liability because the Rebbe knows that having said so, this guy is going
to
do it.
And add a little bit of flavor to it. Let's say he offers the Rebbe 10% of the profits.
Well, then now he's a shutah. Now he's a partner. Now he's a partner, which carries potentially greater liability unless he invests his own. If he invests his own, I brought you a Gemara here earlier on, Ksuva Staf Kuf, which I didn't read aloud, in which the implication was if you would treat your own property this way, then you can treat your partner's property that way as well. Because this is clearly something you believe to be safe, which is very interesting because it doesn't go into at all the differences in risk tolerance between the two parties. There is some discussion of that in the commentary to that passage in the Talmud, which is the case of orphans. There's more to discuss in that case. But that's interesting. Would the Rebbe be responsible? Could he make the argument that you shouldn't have relied on me effectively because what do I know about the...
What do I... People go to their rabbis. They're not going to financial advice, but they are going to only do it if the rabbi
I mean, look, if this is a true Hasidic Rebbe story, then the way it ends is that he comes back to the Rebbe, he says it didn't work, and then he tells him to do something else, and then there's a great lesson that's learned in the end from the experience that he was supposed to have. But I think it's a very interesting question. The non-professional, no, it's really what Alan, I mean, it's a funny case, but think about it. What Alan is asking fundamentally is an important question, which is, what if you don't have the formal training and the professional background in it, but you occupy a position in which people are going to listen to you anyway, what level of responsibility do you have? I think that's a very interesting question.
And it would also go with the fact that in that case, in the case of Areva, there's not going to be any engagement letters or saying that there is no, you know, liability or don't listen to me.
Right, no, it's for sure. I rely on you. That's the way to look at it. Yeah, I think it's a very interesting. I want to think about this one, and that gives me a chance to, again, plug the sign-in sheet, because what I expect to do is to look into this and give you an answer via the email follow-up. So if you aren't signed up yet, make sure you do so to get the answer. Yes, right out of disclaimer.
Blame God.
Blame God. See how far it gets you. Yes.
Category called reasonable expectation, but there has to be a reasonable expectation on the basis of, you always talk about it, you're right, buyer beware.
Right.
So the consumer, the average consumer, has to go into any conversation with a person based on a level of reasonable expectation, and the professional also has a responsibility to give accurate advice based on what's a reasonable expectation. So if I'm running into Metro, I'm at Lawrence Plaza, and I see my doctor there, and I want to ask him a fast advice, he's going to say to me, Rossanne, you know, I'm not in the office right now, I don't have your chart, I don't have this or whatever, so I'll say, well, just tell me really quickly, I'm here, I just want to know, should I buy this, and he'll say, well, you know, get this right now, but call my secretary, make an appointment, and we'll follow up. So when I go and buy whatever I buy, it's the onus is on me. I caught my doctor running out of Metro with groceries in his hand, and I asked him a fast question. Then the onus is on me to also understand, is this a reasonable expectation that he should give me 100% amazing medical advice, or is the onus on me to go and follow up?
All true, but the problems still remain. What is the level of responsibility of the professional or non-professional who gives advice that he knows you're going to rely on, despite his disclaimers? And it's really going to vary depending on what the relationship is. Is it general relationship? Is it duty of care? Is it agency? Is it they're guarding my property or health in the case of a doctor?
Based on the person's profession, they have
there may be an automatic responsibility that they cannot disclaim themselves out of.
They have a credible reputation.
Right. Next week, Rabbi Zirin continues with our second topic. You have the flyer there?
I do.
So what is the topic next week?
The topic is...